I'd like to begin with an apology because, like Professor Jennifer Jackson Priest, I have a cold. In her case, it's coming, in my case, it's going, but I still have enough of it to affect the way I speak. Secondly, like so many previous speakers, I want to thank Gwen and Anne for having invited me to come here today. It's been very interesting. I only wish that I had attended such a seminar or discussion, a workshop, before I was Secretary General instead of after it. And that brings me perhaps to the need to briefly explain why I'm here and how to comment. I was Secretary General of the Council Group for 5 years. I finished my mandate in 2009. And before that, before I began in 2004, I had been a member of the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council Group for 12 years. And by definition, that means I was a member of Parliament in this country. In fact, I was a member of Parliament for a total of 28 years. Before that, I worked in industry for 16 years, mainly in the motor industry. And at times this morning, particularly this morning, but during the day, I did feel a little bit like a car mechanic who had wandered into an assembly of automobile engineers. Because my approach is very practical. Can I take up the invitation which Gwen Sass made this morning when she introduced me as being present and said she was relying on me to point to a few things that might have been missed. And I begin also with something Dayton just said, which is, how do we know a norm entrepreneur when we see one? Well, the answer is it varies a great deal. There's no badge that a norm entrepreneur wears, no uniform, and it will vary from norm to norm. I take up the point that Professor Jackson Priest made, and she said there are multiple actors and multiple entrepreneurs. Sometimes there will be several entrepreneurs working together, not one, on a particular norm. On other occasions, it will be one, but not necessarily an individual. It may be a group of people. I think that one of the points which, of course, the Council is an intergovernmental organisation, and that has to be said very clearly, very firmly, but I think a little bit today that we have underestimated the role of the Court of Human Rights in establishing norms, in its interpretation and judgments on the Convention on Human Rights. The decisions of the Court of Human Rights are not publicised enough. That's not the Court's fault. They do a great deal, everything they can, within the limit of resources, and that's a key issue, within the limit of resources to publicise their decisions, which is absolutely right, because a decision on a case involving the United Kingdom can be replicated in other countries, but it needs to be known in those other countries, it needs to be publicised. And the problem is lack of resources, it's the endemic problem of the Council of Europe. The other role which I think has tended to be underestimated, is the role of the Parliamentary Assembly. Now, don't think that I'm, just because I was a member of the Parliamentary Assembly for 12 years, that I make that point, because on the contrary, I used to get very frustrated with the claims of some of my colleagues in the Parliamentary Assembly who wanted to claim the credit for the Parliamentary Assembly rather than themselves, claim the credit for norm setting and standard setting in the Council of Europe. I felt often it was exaggerated and they ignored other people who played a major part, not least the Secretariat. But nevertheless, it would be quite wrong to overlook their contribution in norm entrepreneurship. Somebody asked, I don't know who it was, because it was behind me, somebody asked this morning, who are these people? And pointed out that she had done some research which showed they were mainly lawyers. That's stopping the research too soon. The people who are in the Parliamentary Assembly are members of Parliament from the member countries. The delegation is made up from sitting members of Parliament. And I think what you need to do is to analyse whether the delegations are representative of the parliaments. It may be that, as used to be in this country, less so now, used to be a very large proportion of members of Parliament were lawyers, mainly barristers, who practice in the courts in London in the morning and take part in Parliament in the afternoon and evening. I think the proportion has reduced greatly, and I welcome, and I speak as someone whose first degree was law, but very few members of a delegation nowadays from the United Kingdom are professional lawyers. And my impression is, looking at my friends from other countries, particularly France, Germany, Scandinavia, that very few of them were professional lawyers either. So, and many of them had not studied law at university. So I think one has to analyse, first of all, the membership of parliaments, and then analyse the membership of delegations to the Parliamentary Assembly. I think there is a presentation by, if I may say so, by Dr. Kunde Sitoli about the role of the Council of Europe Assembly in the abolition of the death penalty. He was very good, spot on, and that's very important. But that's not the only case. A lot of the norms come from reports and recommendations from the Parliamentary Assembly to the Committee of Ministers, or rather to their deputies in practice, the ambassadors. And but that, of course, then begs the question, where did that idea come from? Which is often done in the name of one group of members of the Parliamentary Assembly who ask for a report and a recommendation, which then wends its way through a committee, and then goes to full assembly, and then goes to the Committee of Ministers. I think a lot of the norms have arisen in that way. But there's another way in which the Parliamentary Assembly creates standards and norms, and that is through the admission of new members. That, of course, has come to an end, really, now, because there's only Belarus, as somebody said, I think Graham Avery said, only Belarus, which is the outstanding European country, outstanding in the sense they aren't yet members. And Belarus, of course, is, nobody accepts that Belarus is eligible to join the Council of Europe because it does not meet the criteria, the standards of democracy, human rights, and the rule of law. But whenever, during the explosion of membership, roughly between 1990 and 2005, during those 15 years, the membership of the Council of Europe doubled, large number of countries, mainly from Eastern and Central Europe, joined, and inevitably, conditions on which they joined, the commitments they had to make, were recommended by the Assembly to the Committee of Ministers, who never, in my experience, rejected any of them or amended them. They accepted what the Assembly put forward. And so the Assembly played a major role in extending, spreading the observance of the norms by putting them in as commitments which the governments had to accept. And one of those commitments was that they must immediately, on joining the Council of Europe, sign and ratify the Convention on Human Rights. Also, I might add, the abolition of the death penalty, which is observed in every case but one so far. So, and there are others. I was talking earlier to Mrs. Mallory about the problem of the Meskhetians being repatriated to Georgia. That was a commitment by the Georgian government written in to the conditions, including the conditions on which they joined the Council of Europe, and that came directly from the Assembly, not from the Minister's deputies. And the Assembly does monitor compliance with those commitments. Manuel Azatua mentioned that, and it's a very important role that they have. So the Assembly does play a role, but I'm not exaggerating it. It's only because less was said about that this morning, particularly this morning, than I would have liked, that I'm belabouring the point now. And of course, the Assembly has this monitoring committee specifically charged with monitoring and producing reports about the observance, by compliance, the observance, putting into effect of the commitments made by governments on joining. But there's also another aspect for the Council of Europe. It's not only a case of standard setting and compliance, it's also a case of assistance programmes to improve the observance of the norms. And those assistance programmes are little known, but extremely important. Little publicity given to them, of course, because countries do tend to find, or governments tend, to find that they are slightly humiliating. They don't want to make a big deal out of the fact that the Council of Europe, often financed by the European Union, I must say, is helping them to achieve the standards. But that is a major work. Another part which has been totally overlooked today has been the contribution of the Commissioner for Human Rights. Manuel Azatua over dinner will tell you a lot about that because he was the head of the private office of the Commissioner for Human Rights for several years until I moved him somewhere else, for good reasons, not for bad reasons. He was a very good head of the private office. And the Commissioner for Human Rights, during the 5 years of the term of office, makes a great contribution to improving the norms, extending the norms, and the observance of norms. But then there's the other aspect, which was touched on, particularly by Rainer Hoffman and by Daniel Smiloff, that is the peer review. As exemplified by the Framework Convention on National Minorities and its Advisory Committee, by the Venice Commission, which has done a huge amount of invisible work in improving democracy and everything associated with democracy in relatively new member states. And then there is the committee, which I mentioned, the Committee for the Prevention of Torture, in which I personally took a great deal of interest. And incidentally, the Committee for the Prevention of Torture does not consist of experts nominated by governments. The Committee for the Prevention of Torture, unusually, is appointed on nomination by the Parliamentary Assembly. And it's a delegation from a country that nominates the representative of that country in the Committee for the Prevention of Torture. And the reason I know this very well is that one of my greatest achievements, I think, was before I was Secretary General, when I nominated Silvia Casali as the representative of the United Kingdom in the Committee for Prevention of Torture. And I was actually, I will tell you, this is on confidential terms in chat and all that. Right. I was actually had a telephone call from the then Home Secretary, Jack Straw, who said, Terry, I've got a very good person that I want you to put on the Committee for Prevention of Torture. Now, although it's a delegation, in practice, I discovered my predecessor had done it on his own say-so and chose a Conservative backbench member of Parliament to be like to do it. Anyway, when Jack told me, well, you've got to put forward somebody, Terry, and I got this splendid candidate. I mean, even I heard of him. But I said, no, I'm not going to. I know, Jack, that's not good enough. One, I know he's quite old, much older than me. Second, he's a man. I want you to give me a woman candidate and somebody who will not be, somebody who will be able to go in the middle of winter to a prison in Siberia. And he came up with Silvia Casali's name, but before I nominated her, I went, by coincidence, she was speaking, the all-party group for prison reform. So I was splendid. So I went, I sat at the back, listened to what she had to say, then I went back to Jack and said, that's the woman I want to nominate. Within a very few years, of course, he became chair of the Committee for Prevention of Torture and only resigned from that in order to do a similar job at the United Nations. So, but I emphasise it was only because I was a member of the Parliamentary Assembly that I was able to influence that appointment. So that's another role of the Parliamentary Assembly. But the Committee for Prevention of Torture is a splendid organisation which does a tremendous amount of excellent work. There are other advisory committees like that, peer reviews. Some of them was mentioned by Rainer, the Social Charter, Greco, Moneyval, and above all, trafficking. Now, trafficking was taken up by the Council of Europe, and I'm very proud of the achievement of the Council of Europe in that. It's an ideal subject for the Council of Europe. Why? Because it is a pan-European problem, and the Council of Europe is the pan-European organisation. Trafficking of human beings involves bringing people, mainly women, sometimes children, from countries to the south and east, particularly the southeast of Europe. They pass through countries in Central Europe, like Austria and the Czech Republic. They also come, I must say, from some Baltic countries, and they go, are taken the destination, the countries of destination, of Northern Europe. So by putting together in an organisation which has members in all that area, the countries of origin, the countries of transit, the countries of destination, working together to solve what is definitely an international problem, but working together for an international solution to that problem. And I was very pleased that we managed to get it effective and ratified and put into effect just before I left Strasbourg. And it operates by somebody, I have to say, but being appointed as an expert by the governments, somebody, they meet together, and the members who have ratified, because not all, the members of the Council who have ratified the convention, have to produce a national plan to deal with it. A national plan to deal with it. But that national plan is then examined by all the experts to see whether it's good enough, whether it can be improved. That's what is meant by peer review. And generally speaking, I think peer review is very effective. And the final body that I'll draw attention to, it has not been mentioned, well, one person mentioned briefly, only in passing, is the importance in standard setting and norm entrepreneurship, the importance of a congress of local and regional authorities. I was tremendously impressed by this organisation, which is even less known than anything else in the Council of Europe. The Congress of Local and Regional Authorities consists of representatives from local authorities in all member states. And they have tremendous influence on the laws affecting local government, not least local elections, and monitor them, observe them, and have great influence, and influence each other. The people who attend are often also, well, they're always, I think, yes, they're always, active members, often leaders of local government in the member country. So that has a tremendously important role in boosting local democracy, in standing in solidarity with the representatives in one country who are under pressure from their government, and it's a great example of norm entrepreneurship. But don't get me wrong, I think, was it Professor Chettle who said at the very beginning, we tend to look backwards from an achievement. we really ought to look at the failures. And I think that's right. There have been some failures. I can think of several failures to produce norms. The one which I regret most was on extraordinary rendition, where the Council of Europe looked into that. The Secretary General has a power under the statute to make inquiries of member states to how they're observing their obligation. So that was done, and we had a report. We had answers from every member state, a report which identified three gaps that enabled extraordinary rendition to take place. Totally legal, even under existing legislation, under the Convention on Human Rights, but there were three loopholes. And we recommended from the Secretariat that the Committee of Ministers Deputies should set up a working group to look at these three gaps and fill them. Discuss whether they should be filled. Sorry, not that they should fill them, discuss whether they should be filled. That was a failure. Got nowhere. Got nowhere because the opposition from the United Kingdom and from France. The United Kingdom was the most vocal, France just had to agree with them. And they stopped it. They stopped it, of course, for very understandable political reasons, recognising who's responsible for extraordinary rendition. So this is a clear example of a transatlantic alliance working. But that was a failure. And I, in retrospect, I don't think there was much more the Secretary could have done. Some countries did try to push it forward. Switzerland and some Scandinavian countries came together. I think the Netherlands might have been in that group as well. And they had a special meeting, a caucus, to try to move it forward and decided they couldn't and wouldn't because it would have meant standing up for the majority, and particularly to the big boys. I say big boys, big payers. Grand payer is a proper expression. And they didn't want to take on the Brits and the French in particular. And no doubt the Russians on this occasion were happy to just keep quiet. And of course a number of countries in Central Europe knew that they were implicated. And so there's no enthusiasm even for looking at it. So that was a failure. There were others I can think of. But can I just finish on an anecdote from May, which may amuse you because I was very interested in Anne Dayton's analysis of the roles of Ernie Bevin and Winston Churchill. And it now explains something to me. Not quite understood before. And the issue is, the question is, why is the Council of Europe in Strasbourg? Why Strasbourg? I mean, the theory, the official explanation is, Strasbourg is, of course, on the Rhine, it's on the border between France and Germany, and it's a gesture, a symbol of reconciliation between these two countries, which have had three wars in less than 100 years. That's not true. That's the myth. I can tell you the real reason why the Council Group is located in Strasbourg. And it's all down to Ernie Bevin. The civil servants went to Ernie Bevin and they gave him a list of the most beautiful countries in the founding states of the Council of Europe. Lyon, Bordeaux, Grenoble, Strasbourg, Florence, Siena, Amsterdam. You can see the picture. Ernie Bevin said, I've only got one question here. And I understand why now, in view of what you've told me about Winston Churchill's mischief-making in the Assembly in those days, because he was in opposition. Ernie Bevin said, I've got one question. So Humphrey, tell me, which of these cities is the most difficult to get to, because I do not want our members of Parliament spending any more time than necessary in this place. And I said, well, Sir Humphrey said, oh, well, Minister, I must say that the most difficult place, the most inaccessible place on this list is Strasbourg. Right, said Ernie, that's where it will be. And I might add, it's still the most inaccessible. So I finish on that little anecdote, and now I'm prepared to answer any questions people want to put in.